welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We have a quorum, so we're going to start. Try to move through our agenda this Friday afternoon. Want to welcome our visitors here. I think we have a number of students from the Beaverton School District. Is that right?
Highland Park.
What park is it?
Yeah, from Highland Park.
Y'all from Highland Park? All right. Well, welcome here to the Capitol today. We're glad to have you here watching a committee hearing. You've come to one of the most exciting and interesting committees in the legislature, and we're glad you're here. And just to prove that, we're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2646 relating to judgments. Open the work session, and I've got Dave Kanagi. Is it Dave Hendricks? There you are, David. Okay, Dave Hendricks. Brad, do you want to come forward? And Randy, do you want to come up? And why don't we talk about judgments? And I'm going to start with you, Mr. Hendricks, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel. You should have a copy of some -2 amendments to the bill, as well as some comments that were put together by Randy Jordan here, sitting at the end of the table, relating to the amendments. These were amendments that were put together for several wide range of reasons. Obviously, some of them are just corrections to things as people ran through this really long bill trying to make sure that everything was right. And in addition, there are many, many changes that have been made that were addressed to the costs that were going to be incurred if they were immediately implemented in the courts as far as the problems with the computer system, et cetera. Although I will say that the changes for those purposes are not terribly extensive. When you go through the amendments, you find that primarily what was involved was terminology issues, where they didn't want to have to change the terminology used in the computer records, and things like the notices that are sent out when judgments are issued, the problem with the computer spitting out a form that doesn't look like what the bill was going to require, and then probably the principal problem, which was that the requirement of labeling a judgment in a certain way, that requirement is still in the bill, the requirement that it be labeled as either a general limit or supplemental judgment, but there is a fallback position put into the bill now that if a judgment does make it into the register, we are hoping the computer could stop it from getting there, but that's not possible without a fairly substantial cost to the courts. To resolve that, we have put in a default rule that if a judgment goes in and all it says is judgment, it will be treated as a general judgment of the bill, and then put in a procedure to allow a motion to basically, for a party who put one of those judgments in, that any party in that action come back at a later date and say, no, this was not intended to be a general judgment. That is a judgment to end the entire case. So I'm happy to address anything else in the amendments or any other questions there may in the bill. If you want more specificity, I can give it, but I'd hate to completely put the students off from civic duty forever, and that might result from an item-by-item one.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Mr. Swank, do these amendments satisfy the court with its concerns with respect to the cost impacts?
For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. Chair Williams, members of the committee, we've had a brief time to look at these. We worked very hard with David, Mr. Hendricks, to work through amendments and concepts to make sure that we were trying to eliminate all of the costs that we could. It looks like at the current time we're going to be able to give an indeterminate fiscal impact. We, of course, will be continuing to look for things. As you know, in my branch of government, the exact words are very important, and when the printed bill comes out again, we will be sending them out for comments to make sure that we haven't missed something, to make sure that everything's picked up and that there are no unnecessary costs in this or things that cause us to have to do a fiscal. So we'll be looking for that, and we'll bring them to Dave so that can be cleared up on the Senate side if the problems continue. But we continue to work and look and try and make the bill workable and without additional cost, because, as you know, we've been very supportive of this process for the last 8 years and put in hundreds of hours to try and make it work.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Jordan, just as a member of the work group for the Law Commission, these amendments represent the consensus of the work group, in your opinion?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, yes, it does. We had a recent meeting where we covered almost all of these amendments specifically, and I anticipate that we'll send the rest of them by the committee, I mean by the work group again. But yes, they did meet the satisfaction of the members.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Williams, I will say that because of the amount of work that was done in the last week, it wasn't possible to send them out to the work group to make sure that each of the individual changes were approved. We will send those out as soon as possible and tell people that if there are any issues they have, that we'll address them in the Senate and try to get changes at that
right.
point.
And that'll be the commitment that I make as well. Obviously, you know, this bill is the product of, for some people, almost 4 years' worth of effort. For others, at least 2 years' worth of effort. We'll continue to hone it and refine it. My concern is if we don't move the bill now, we're gonna start running out of time. And so to the extent there are additional issues that need to be addressed, and I can almost guarantee you there will be, because this is an extremely large bill, and you know, some people are going to get around to reading it, and they're going to raise some issues that, you know, even the 40-plus people that have been involved in this effort thus far haven't maybe thought about. Are there questions for the panel on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jensen.
You mean I didn't have to read it?
Well, no, I'm glad you did. In fact, just by that statement alone, we're going to add you to the work group, Representative Jensen.
Chair Williams.
Yes.
I might add, one of the groups that I worked with on amendments was Juvenile. The juvenile group, and who there are some amendments in here to address some concerns that they had, but they also, it sparked their interest enough that they said that they would probably need an interim work group to work specifically on judgments as they relate to juvenile cases. So I suspect that the issue of judgments is not a dead one.
Well, it'll be sort of like the garnishment bill rewrite. It'll come back several times, I'm sure, before we're done. All right. With that, the chair would move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2646. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted.
I must be the chair of Juvenile Work Group.
Well, we're glad you got a chance to see that exciting work in action.
Yeah. How they all know what they don't want to be.
We just cured that.
Yeah, I understand. We'll wait till the room clears. All right. Well, now we're back to just the usual suspects. All right, the chair would move the amended version of House Bill 2646 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Hearing none, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Excused.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2646, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And having chaired the work group for the last 4 years on this issue, I will assign myself carrier. Next, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2696. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, if you recall, House Bill 2696 modifies the definition of public assistance and provides an opportunity for a hearing when DHS proposes to refuse, suspend, or revoke public assistance benefits. One of the things that we talked about at length in our last hearing was the issue of whether or not food stamps should be included in this benefit. I don't have any amendments. I believe that
I think there
that
are,
issue has been worked out. But
I think there are amendments. Mr. Taylor has them. Do you have copies, Mr. Taylor, or would we need to make them?
I didn't realize you need them.
Okay. Why don't you go make copies for us? With that said, why don't we bring up Mr. Taylor, and then do you want to come up, Lisa? You want to tell us sort of where we're at in the process on this bill?
At our last public hearing, we talked a little bit about the need to have a process for folks who were appealing secondary job benefits that was housed within the executive branch rather than going through the circuit court process. The one question that was most on the minds of the committee was, is there going to be a fiscal impact on that and how? With some assistance from Representative Williams, who is the chief sponsor of the bill, and the Department of Human Services staff, we were able to isolate in the bill a definition of what we were trying to accomplish that narrowed the bill considerably, took food stamps and other programs out of it, and now applies specifically to secondary benefits for the jobs program. And under these amendments that you will soon receive, the bill will have only that scope and will allow for an expedited hearing process. The estimates for the number of hearings that we expect in a biennium will be less than one a month, and based on that, the fiscal impact would be quite low, and there is a offset in unnecessary costs at the circuit court level, because these will no longer go to the circuit court, which we believe will actually create a small savings for the state of Oregon. And to the extent that that's part of your discussion, I would let the rest of that go to my colleague from the Department of Human Services, Lisa Joyce.
Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you very much.
For
the record, I'm Lisa Joyce with the Department of Human Services. And when we initially came to this committee with this bill, it had a very broad scope and large unintended consequences. And we're delighted to see this narrowed down and focused on what we think was the original target, which was support service payments under the JOBS program. Our intention is at DHS to keep the costs down in this process by using our informal conciliation process and alternative dispute resolution to the greatest degree possible. And the fiscal that we have developed, and I understand LFO has not yet developed one, assumes that we use conciliation, alternative dispute resolution, and only go to an expedited hearing in a small number of cases.
Okay. Are there questions for either Mr. Taylor or Ms. Joyce about the Dash 1 amendments? Speak now, colleagues, or forever hold your peace. Is there anything else either of you feel like you need to put on the record at this point regarding the bill or the amendments?
Just one other comment I'd make is that there was an unresolved issue that got taken out of the bill, and that was the question of whether or not there would be standards required for when someone would or would not receive a secondary benefit. The current system allows for a great deal of flexibility on the part of caseworkers to determine what a need is. It's still our position that it would be better to have some consistent standards so that you didn't have the system have a certain component of arbitrariness to it. But for the purposes of today's hearing, this is a much cleaner and easier way to go, and we may bring that issue back up on the Senate side.
Okay, and Lisa, I think it's the department's position still that they'd like the flexibility and not to have the standards in the bill. That being said, the department accepts the Dash 1 amendments as its position on the bill. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So, Representative Prozanski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 1s in the House Bill 2696.
Representative Prozanski moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2696. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The dash ones are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, now move House Bill 2696 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Prusansky moves House Bill 2696 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Okay, hearing none, call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative
Jensen? Aye.
Representative
Crummell? Aye. Representative McPherson? Aye. Representative Krasinski? Aye. Representative Krasinski? Aye. Representative Shetterly? Aye. Vice Chair Ackerman? Aye. Vice Chair Anderson? Excused.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2696 is amended and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you both very much. Well, I'm the risk of sounding like I'm hogging all the bills today, colleagues. As the chief sponsor, I feel somewhat obligated to carry that one on the floor unless anybody else wants to volunteer. Okay. Looks like we got another group of spectators coming in, so we'll let them get seated.
So they're not all going to testify?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
While we're waiting, oh, what happened to Representative Shetterly?
He's out in the hall with the
I think he snuck out when they...
Oh, okay. Well, we'll do that in a minute.
We...
Yeah, so far we've just taken an order and done the first two bills. 2646 and 2690.
Well, first we want to welcome our visitors. Are you folks all from Highland Park too?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, we're glad you're here. This is, you'll find this to be the most interesting and entertaining committee in the building, along with the members who are the best looking. So we appreciate you being here. And to show you how entertaining it is today, I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2706. This is a bill that creates a land surveyor lien for performance of land surveying activities. Now, if that isn't excitement, I don't know what is. And even better, you're going to get to hear from two of the building's most venerate lobbyists. That's actually a nice word for people who've been around way too long. I'm going to bring up Mr. Kafori and Mr. Marquis. Well, you got to come up, Jim, because we're going to talk at least about the amendments, and we're going to give you a chance to get that on the record. Start with you, Mr. Kafori, about 2706 and the dash threes that we have in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Marquis for pointing out some flaws in the bill that I presented to you the other day. I took those suggestions and had a couple of amendments drafted. I'd like to talk about the dash threes first. It was pointed out that in the miscellaneous section of the lien law, there is a section that talks about priorities, and this new amendment to that didn't have anything about priorities. So what this amendment dash three does is put us at the bottom, at the end. The lien for the miscellaneous lien for surveyors will be after everything else in this chapter 87 miscellaneous section.
Okay. That's the dash threes.
That's the dash threes.
All right. And then tell us that we've also got a set of dash twos. Do you want to talk about the dash twos?
Oh, I'd rather not talk about the dash twos, Mr. Chair. A funny thing happened on the way to the drafting. As you know, if you don't sit down with a drafter and explain exactly what you want and you're forced to do it by note, sometimes the intent doesn't get across. Again, I'd like to thank Mr. Marquis for pointing out that there was, if we adopted the dash two amendments, which allowed an agent to make a contract for surveying and then lien would be could be applied to the land, there was a concern about what happens if the agent doesn't tell the owner, then the owner might have a lien on his property without having been known, having notification of it. So I asked to have notification. I had expected what would happen would there would be a draft and an amendment that said that the potential lienor, the surveyor, would have to notify the owner in the case that there was an agent, that give some notification of the lien, potential lien. But what was drafted instead, it said that the agent has to give notice to the owner. And I don't think that's at all what Mr. Marquis had in mind.
Not a bad idea, though.
It's not a bad idea in addition, but I think it leaves out the concern that Mr. Marquis raised, which I think is a reasonable concern.
Okay. So the dash twos came back not as you had intended them.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. But the point that the point about the notice is something that you're willing to incorporate into the bill.
Absolutely.
It's not in the form that it's currently in. Okay, Jim. Mr. Marquis, I mean, we know you don't like the bill generally, but, I mean, have you had a chance to look at the amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis for the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, I'm looking at the amendments. I had seen the dash twos earlier and wondered what Mr. Cafori was doing, but with Mr. Cafori, one never knows, so I wanted him, wanted you to hear it from him.
All right.
These amendments, I guess, you know, just don't quite do it for us. We still don't believe that this is a necessary lien, and frankly, we think there are alternatives. And I want to reiterate that most of these are small amounts of money that we're talking about, and if they were a judgment lien of less than $3,000, where Mr. Cafori's clients had actually went to court and had the amount in the contract that was owed adjudicated, his client would be prohibited from executing against any real property that was a homestead to satisfy a judgment of less than $3,000. Because the legislature made that a policy many years ago and has stuck with it. And so in these instances, for these very small amounts of money, you're going to allow one class of people to execute on a very small lien against a person's home when if they went to court and got it adjudicated and got a judgment lien, they wouldn't be able to do it.
Mr. Marquis, on the dash threes that put the lien at the bottom of the priority list, you think that's a good idea, though, right? That satisfies at least the issue you raised with respect to where does it...
At least it has a priority.
Okay. All right.
It does do that.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for either of these gentlemen? Representative Prosansky?
I wonder if Mr. Corey wants to respond to what Mr. Marquis just said as to the $3,000 or less against the homestead. And is that actually going to be allowed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prosansky, thank you for the opportunity to respond. In talking with my clients, and I think I forgot to say my name, Stephen Cafori, representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. I think that may be a first in about 20 years of being in front of you. After talking to my clients, surveyors, they are incapable of coming up with any time ever that any of them have ever foreclosed on a lien, and they've had these lien rights since construction lien rights were initially granted. They don't use these for foreclosure purposes. They use them for purposes saying, please pay me the money, and I'll put a lien on your property if you don't, and that results in payment being made. Foreclosure is not something that has ever happened, and we don't anticipate that it will ever happen.
Representative Prosansky.
Mr. Chair, I guess ask Mr. Cafori, if this bill was to move out of committee, would your clients be willing to amend the bill on the Senate side to include an exemption from filing or getting this, what I would consider now, what I've just heard for the first time, a higher priority of actually being able to file a lien, or they wouldn't be able to if it went through small claims court and was under $3,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prosansky, I have not raised that question with him, so I can't give you an honest answer. I frankly do not know, and I guess part of that would be a political response. I mean, I've been around this building a long time, and I know sometimes you accept changes that you're not excited about in order to get a bill passed. But I also know that you don't accept changes if you don't need them to get a bill passed. So I guess I will put that to you. That's your decision to make.
Okay. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. And I am going to, in the interest of expediency, not move the adoption of the Dash 2s because they weren't the amendments that Mr. Kefouri thought he was requesting. But we have a commitment that if this bill were to make it to the Senate, you would work on the notice piece in the Senate. Is that right?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
So the chair is going to move the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2706. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The threes are in the bill. The chair would now move...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There's also Dash 1 amendments which were proposed at the hearing, but we didn't discuss... And the Dash 1 amendment is the amendment that puts the agent as well as the owner into the game.
I'm seeking.
You should have a copy of that when I get
it. Did we adopt that in the previous?
Mr. Chair, there's been no work session, only a hearing.
All right. Okay.
And
Mr. Markey.
Mr. Chair, since you're dealing with the notice issue of the agent in the Senate, perhaps you might want to deal with all of the issues relating to agents in the Senate.
Well, it seems reasonable to adopt the Dash 1s, it seems to me, at this stage of the game, and allow the notice piece to be the one unresolved issue. But I appreciate the offer of assistance, Mr. Markey. So the chair would now move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2706. We'll pause just briefly and thank our friends from Highland Park for coming by. We hope it's been entertaining. So I'll move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2706. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, the ones and the threes are in the bill. With that, the chair would move House Bill 2706 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
I think Mr. Markey had a point, I guess, in maintaining some parity. Again, if we're talking about doing this on the Senate side, I think it would be worth looking in the Senate for a homestead exemption, something to that effect, to put this on par with it will still be superior to judgments in a small claims action, since you can get this without any kind of legal proceeding. But where we have that $3,000 exemption, maybe some sort of homestead exemption for liens under $3,000. I just recommend that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Looks like we've got another group from Highland Park Middle School. You guys all from Highland Park? Oh, well, we're glad to have you here. This is not only the most entertaining and informed committee, but also the best-looking committee. How many times am I going to get to say that today? All right, so Representative Shetterly has made his point on House Bill 2706.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I'd like to just acknowledge I agree with Representative Shetterly based on the information I've heard. It does seem, I mean, this is the one part, the frustration of not having institutional memory to be able to, say, bring this forward. And I think that would be a good suggestion. I'll support the floor, but I hope that we maybe can have whoever's carrying the bill address that issue once Mr. Corey has an opportunity to speak with his clients as to whether or not they're willing to look at doing that on the Senate side.
Okay. Anybody else want to speak to 2706 and the motion to move it as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation? All right, then. Ann, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kuzonski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2706 is amended. Moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll go there. I need a carrier on that bill.
Representative Barker?
Yes, sir.
You've been assigned. Thank you very much for your volunteerism. Colleagues, you got a separate schedule for the 1:30 matter of business that we noticed up yesterday. So based on that, I'm going to ask Representative Ackerman for his motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for the purposes of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2523.
Representative Ackerman moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2523. It's an undebatable motion, and those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2523 will say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion carries, and the rules are suspended. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2523 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2523 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Committee, this is the bill that, as you will recall, related to the Justice of the Peace District creation in Deschutes County. We passed this bill out to the floor before we received information on the fiscal. Both the county and the courts have been discussing and working on the issue of the fiscal. It appears clear to me that, and I believe to the participants, that the fiscal will exceed the threshold that would normally allow us to move a bill to the floor without it first going to Ways and Means. So it is the chair's intention that we move this bill to the Ways and Means Committee, where they will do what they'll do with it there. So that is the discussion. So I think I had that before I said those of the opinion that we did I do the reconsidering? I didn't.
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did we reconsider? All right. So Representative Ackerman.
I move that House Bill 2523 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Ackerman moves that House Bill 2523 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All right. Those of the opinion that we do that will say aye.
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 Those opposed? All right, the bill will go to the Ways and Means Committee, and I've signed that letter notifying the Speaker. Okay, thank you, Committee. We are now going to move to 30. Oh, these are Bill Taylor's bills. All right, we'll do 3539. I'll open a work session on House Bill 3539. And, Council, maybe you can bring us up to date.
They're in the hall.
Oh, are they?
Oh.
You want to get them?
He's seemingly doing all my work for me today. He moved the chairs.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3539 is a bill with regard to protecting sellers of residential property from liens filed against the property by individuals who did work, assumably for the buyer. If you recall, this situation often arises in new construction, speculative construction, where the proceeds of the sale are going to pay for, in part, the construction costs. When the subcontractors are not paid, they will file a lien against the property. The buyers had no involvement in that that construction, but they will actually be the ones affected by the lien because they've now bought the property. We have Dash 1 amendments in front of us. They did not come through me, so I...
Representative Merkley is here to discuss this bill. Representative Merkley. Hand kick the can over there.
More excitement.
Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the chance to hear this bill, the Home Buyer Protection Act. We have in Oregon a situation where at the moment that a family buys a home, there's a peculiar form of risk. That is that unrecorded rights to liens, and because they're not recorded, the buyer doesn't know of their existence, exist. And then after they have bought the house, those who have those rights to lien perfect them, or can perfect them if they haven't been paid. And this is like a financial landmine going off under the homeowner. This situation we addressed 2 years ago by saying the seller has to do full disclosure, a comprehensive list of all the rights to lien, producing either waivers of those liens, so on and so forth. And this proved to be an unworkable solution because some rights to lien are implicit. That is, they're never documented in paper to begin with. And because tracking all those rights liens is not something that's ordinary practice in the residential construction business, it is in the commercial side of things. And therefore, we suspended this bill and put it off for 2 years while trying to work for a better solution. I bring you today the result of those 2 years of discussion, and I'll say that I think that because this bill touches on so many stakeholders, banks, mortgage brokers, title companies, real estate industry, contractors, subcontractors, that this, it's been a complicated effort to weave the best solution, providing some protection to the buyer while making a workable and efficient system. What we have before you is a choice of the seller to provide some protection to the buyer through one of a number of possible mechanisms. One mechanism is simply to, and this is in the dash one, it's simply to disclose to the buyer Oregon law, say that this means there's substantial risk, and if you understand this and wish to assume that risk, sign here. So that's one potential mechanism the seller can use. A second is to go and get waivers from all of the major right to lien holders, those who hold a right to lien of over $5,000, and by providing those to the buyer, that substantially reduces the risk to the buyer. A third approach is for the seller to wait the time period out that in which rights to lien can be converted. They can be converted for 75 days after substantial completion. And so, for example, if I sign a contract with someone to buy a house and there's 20 days left on that 75 days, it might take the buyer those 20 days to simply get their mortgage lined up and go to closing. But if they were ready to go to closing before those 75 days, I could simply say, let's hold off another 3 or 4 days, get past the time period when these rights to lien can be perfected, and then you're completely protected from that issue. Another mechanism we put in was to provide a form of title insurance that addresses this issue. This is a form of title insurance that banks get because banks are very aware of this issue and don't want to be exposed to the potential of these cured rights to lien. Banks will not provide a mortgage in many cases if they can't get that title insurance, and title companies won't issue it to builders that they don't believe have the solvency necessary to make sure that the risk is modest. So although that's not a solution that will work in every place, it's one of the palette that we've laid out of solutions. Also, the possibility of leaving 25% of the value of the house in escrow till the 75 days expires, or of obtaining a bond or a letter of credit until that 75 days expires. So there are six mechanisms in here that came out of the discussions that have been put forward all as reasonable ways, but we wanted to give the choice to the seller because different sellers are in very different circumstances. Those with an established or an established builder, established relationship with title companies and financial institutions, their easiest solution probably is simply the title insurance approach. For others, they're a small builder, they're just getting started, they don't have the liquidity, they can't leave anything in escrow, they can't get the title coverage, they're just going to go out and get the waivers. Or they're going to go to the customer and say, here is a disclosure of the risk, and if you're willing to accept it, let's go forward. If not, let's wait till the 75 days expires. So that is essentially the bill. I think that there are a number of stakeholders here who will tell you that they're nervous about this, or neutral and nervous, and there are, because it is complex, I anticipate we'll continue to try to iron out issues. The title companies raised an issue. We provided one fix, and we're going to continue conversations about whether more is needed. Real estate agents wanted to make sure that they were protected from an error by the seller, and I think we've worked with their lawyers, and we have the language in the dash one that their lawyers recommended to protect them. The builders asked for a number of ideas to be addressed, and I think we've addressed those, but they will have others as we proceed to trying to balance all of these complex intersecting interests. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Merkley. Are there questions, Representative Barker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Merkley, Representative Merkley, when I bought last time I bought a home, which has been quite a while ago, a new house, I had title insurance, which I thought protected me, and why wouldn't that not work in this case?
Thank you very much, Representative Barker. I did exactly the same thing, and when a friend called me up and said that she was starting to receive all these lien notices after she and her husband and seven children moved into a house, I said, that can't be right. Surely you're protected by your title insurance. But regular title insurance protects you only against things that are recorded, and rights to lien are unrecorded. They may be documented by paper put into the hands of the builder or the owner of the land, and in some cases, not, even that's not required. I believe with rental equipment providers, no paper documentation is required. And so it's those rights to lien, unrecorded, the title company has no way of finding them, that cause the problem. And that's where the higher level of extended title coverage comes in, but consumers just don't know that that's an option, and if the title company doesn't trust the builder, it's not an option.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, why don't we bring... Oh, Representative Ackerman, I was going to bring up the panel of nervous neutrals, but we can do that in just a minute. Go ahead.
Yes, just briefly, Representative, we had this discussion, and I am not familiar that any insurance, any title insurance company would insure against the risk that you've that is proposed in subsection 2A of the bill. Are we going to have any documentation today that insurance companies, title insurance companies, will write this type of risk?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman. During our discussions of stakeholders last year, we were briefed on this product, often called Alta Extended, and its role in the banking industry, because banks do not want to have a situation where they end up without coverage against these uncured liens. We were told that customers could buy this policy, and I'd heard it mentioned in the past, but I wasn't aware of the details of it. Today, in discussing this with representative title companies, some question arose as to whether there are fine points here that need to be further addressed, but we don't know what those fine points are yet. And so the lawyers immersed in the title company world are taking another look at this and saying this is work or not for that particular option. It is one of the six options. There's nothing that compels a title company to issue such a policy. But it was my understanding up until a few hours ago that this was a feasible and appropriate solution. I believe it's the one that the builders believe would be most often used.
Thank you.
Okay.
May I ask the representative a quick question?
You may, Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In utilizing the title insurance or escrow mechanism, the bonding or the bonding mechanism, what happens to the money if there are no claims made against it, but there's been money placed against title insurance? I understand that's just an insurance policy, but for a bond or for a bond or for escrow, there's actually dollars that have been placed into an account. Number one, who places them there? Number two, what happens to the money if it's not you, if there's no lien claim?
Okay. I'll start with the. Thank you very much, Representative Crummel, Mr. Chair. I'll start with the bonding. When you buy a bond, no money is really put into an account. It's like a lot like buying an insurance policy, limited to a particular specific cause. If nothing arises that requires that bond, the bondholder has purchased insurance, but the insurance wasn't needed, and the person who wrote the bond made on that particular bond a bit of profit. So it's very much like an insurance policy in that sense. It would expire, theoretically, if this was written to cover the 75 days from substantial completion. That is the time period in which rights to lien can be converted to liens. The bond would simply expire at that time, just as if you buy a one-year bond, it covers you for 1 year.
Correct.
With the escrow, if for example, if I was selling a house, and I would say this is not an option one would use unless the seller has liquidity and can afford to leave some money in escrow for a while. That's why it's one of a number of options and not an exclusive remedy. But if I sold a house for $200,000, I could leave $50,000 in escrow, and then when the 75 days expired, the title company releases the money back to me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you, Representative. I'd like to see a show of hands from those who want to speak to this bill. Mr. Boyd, I've got Mr. Berry, Ms. Jarvis, I've got Jack, I've got Jim. I know that, anybody else? What about the credit managers folks? I thought they were going to be in here today. All right. Jeff, do you want to introduce this to somebody?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. This is Vernette Arnell. And Vernette worked with me in my years at Human Solutions. And when I referred earlier to when a friend called me up and said she was starting to receive letters from the subcontractors who built the house, and she couldn't possibly owe them, could she? And I said, no, you couldn't possibly owe them. It was Vernette who called me, and unfortunately, as we soon discovered, she did owe them. And I know time is very brief, but if the chair has time, she could share a word or two about her experience.
We were just about ready to get to the substantive issues on the bill, but we'll go ahead and give you just a minute to sort of just tell us briefly your story.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. As Jeff said, we purchased a new home and bought it from the contractor and moved in with our family of seven children. And shortly after we moved in, we started receiving many letters from subcontractors indicating that there were liens on our house. And at the highest point, we had 13 liens on our house, and they equaled half again what we had paid for the house initially. And we came to the point at one time where we were one day away from a sheriff's sale, and the contractor was settling the liens slowly for pennies on the dollar, and we were in danger of losing our house altogether because of the liens. So it's an important issue. We had no idea, of course, that there were these liens on the property when we purchased it, and thought that when we paid our money that, you know, that's what that money was going for.
Okay. No, we really do appreciate you coming down and giving a human face to what's, I'm sure we're going to learn here in about 30 seconds, is an extremely complicated issue. Are there questions at all? All right. Thank you, committee. Thank you very much. All right. Why don't we bring you up in panels? Mr. Boyd, do you want to come up from the contractors board? Mr. Berry and Ms. Jarvis, we'll put you three in the hot seats first. And why don't we start out with you, Bill, just from the agency perspective?
I am a neutral, but not a nervous neutral, because we don't really have a stake in this. But there was we did do a fiscal impact statement on this that was based on the original bill. The Dash 1 amendments eliminate that fiscal impact. The original bill had us storing documents for every home sale that was involved in the bill, and that would have required somebody to image and index those documents. Well, since we don't do that under the Dash 1 amendments, that takes care of that. I will say that the board hasn't taken a position on the bill, but I was part of the work group. It's a fairly complicated issue, but in the original bill from 2 years ago would have been quite unworkable, and at least this, I think, is a workable solution. Maybe it can be improved, but it's better than what we had.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Appreciate that. Mr. Berry?
Scott Berry, representing the Oregon Building Industry Association. And House Bill 3539, I think, represents an attempt, and still in its early stages, to try to solve problems created by a small window that occasionally affects the homeowner, and it's certainly a problem that needs to be addressed. House Bill 3842 attempted to address that. It had obviously some problems with it. That bill was postponed during the first special session of 2002. And again, this is an attempt to try to come back and take a look at that. Section 7 of the bill is something we're very much needing in our industry, and that's the removal of House Bill 3842 and everything that went with it during the 2002 special session. In addition to that, I got the new amendments today, had a chance to take a look at them. They are a major improvement over the original bill, but that we still have some concerns, and want to continue working on this issue as the bill moves forward.
Can you tell us what your concerns are briefly on the Dash 1, Scott?
I think you heard a little bit, Representative Merkley touched on it slightly with the title insurance, and just assuring that issue is available under this bill, because if that's not available, then we have we have serious problems. That bill will be used, I would say, by 90 to 95% of our builders. They move through this process, and if it's available in some cases, as it's been at least initially explained, the title insurance companies may just go ahead and offer that to their builder clients. However, if that is not the case, and I think that's still up in the air right now, then we need that certainly needs to be solved.
Okay.
Secondly,
can I just hold? Well, they're clear in the room. Thanks, all our friends from Highland Park, for coming to visit. We hope you saw how thrilling and exciting it is to be a legislator.
Not a group of kids cared.
That's what my kids do when I start reading to them. Do they fall asleep or
they get up and walk out?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and give us your second point, Scott?
Second point is there is currently a criminal penalty in the bill, and while we believe that a civil penalty is needed, we have great concern with a criminal penalty being involved in a case where an entity or business goes bankrupt.
Okay.
Just one other point. This issue occurs. We have heard of this issue occurring. It just doesn't occur very often at all. In fact, for it to occur, really, the builder, the company needs to go bankrupt. They lose their bond, they lose their license, et cetera. Having said that, it's still a problem that needs to be addressed. It's not something that occurs on a regular basis.
And when you indicated, Scott, on the bill, the Section 7, if we don't enact Section 7, then what we did in the 2001 section revives, right? In the special session, we suspended its operation, but we didn't eliminate it, and it springs back to life if we don't take some action
to deal with
Section 7.
Chair Williams, that's correct. All the concerns we have about that bill and the problems that I think everyone recognized a little bit too late will be right back in place.
Okay. All right. Ms. Jarvis?
Thank you. Janet Jarvis for the Oregon Association of Realtors. Yes, Chair Williams, I was going to mention that as well. We did manage to delay the implementation date in the last special session, but it is coming back to us this July without some kind of fix. Our concern was in House Bill 3842, while this has been discussed as being a bill directed at new home construction issues in Section 7 of House Bill 3842. Section 3 of House Bill 3842, it brought in all real property transactions and broadened the scope substantially. And that's where my members became concerned. And so Representative Merkley has addressed our concerns in his fix in House Bill 3539, just for the record.
And the Dash 1 amendments include
Correct.
That
yes.
fix?
Yes, they
okay.
do.
All right. Are there questions for this panel of nervous and not nervous neutrals? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I just want to reiterate my question about the title insurance. Again, in my limited experience in real estate, I've never seen a title insurance company that would write this type of policy, but yet I haven't really had a need for it. Do you have any information you can provide to us about your experience in such policies or whether you've contacted any title insurance companies that could provide documentation that they will cover this?
Or do you want to defer to Jack Monroe, who I'm going to call up and
exactly.
who's going to talk, who represents the title insurance company?
All right.
Thank you.
I'll ask the right question to the right person.
All right.
I'll withdraw my question.
Okay. Thank you. Next up, Mr. Marquis, Mr. Monroe. Who else? All right. And colleagues, check your bill file, but didn't NACM have a
yes.
memorandum in opposition to the bill?
Yes.
Okay. It's not in mine, but I thought I saw it earlier. So, and I don't see them here. Are they here? Okay. Why don't we start with you, Mr. Monroe, since title insurance seems to be a burning question for Representative Ackerman.
For the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. It's a pleasure to be in front of the handsomest committee in the legislature, but I
Indeed.
Do have to note how quickly you can clear a room. We were not part of the working group and so have not been working through the development of this measure, but and unfortunately my two technical people managed to take the same week to be on vacation, but essentially, I think Representative Ackerman is correct, and our concern with what we see here is a sort of technical concern, and essentially the kind of product that we commonly sell, and the price structure for that product isn't consistent with the language that's in here. And so we have, however, indicated to the sponsor that this bill, at least as it relates to title insurance, needs some additional manipulation, and he is quite receptive to doing that. And I understand, obviously, your interest in moving something, and we're quite willing to work with him as this thing moves to the Senate and through that Senate process. So with that, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Okay, thanks. Are there questions? Representative Ackerman.
I'm still not hearing that this is a... Is this an insurance product that's on the market now?
Well, Representative Williams, Representative Ackerman, unfortunately, I'm not a title insurance expert, but I think the answer to your question is no, that commonly we would not sell a limited duration title policy of this type. So we're going to, as I say, we're going to arrange to get title insurance counsel down here to get together with Representative Merkley and attempt to resolve the problem if we can.
Thank you.
Mr. Markey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of the Mortgage Lenders Association. I'm here to encourage you to move forward House Bill 3539 with the amendments. I think the bill that passed last session didn't work. I want to tell you that Representative Merkley has shown the patience of Job trying to work through this very complex issue with any number of people in any number of meetings, and I've attended a lot of those meetings, and I've learned more about this issue than I wanted to know. There is some problem out there, I think, that this attempts to fix. Is it a perfect bill? Perhaps not. I can't answer Representative Ackerman's question, although my best recollection from the title insurance person who was at a couple of the meetings I attended, I thought there was such a product available. Perhaps we can work on that in the Senate. I think it's time to move a bill forward. I think this problem does need to be fixed, and I want to compliment Representative Merkley for trying to do something about it.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Markey or Mr. Monroe that haven't been asked? All right, thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else here who feels impressed to speak on House Bill 3539? Okay. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go ahead and move the amendment, but I think before I do that, I just want to put on the record that looking at the literature that came in from NACM appears to be dealing with the original bill. Does not look like it's addressing the Dash 1, so their position may be different today. With that said, if the Chair would entertain the motion, I will move the Dash 1 into House Bill 3539.
Representative Brzezinski moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3539. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection? The Dash 1s are adopted. Representative, I want to bring, why don't I bring Representative Merkley back, and how about I bring back Ms. Jarvis and Mr. Berry for just a brief moment here at the table? I think everybody agrees that there's some things in this bill that still need to get worked on and that you guys have some concerns about. I'll put on the record that I'm concerned about the criminal penalty issue within the bill. I think that this kind of a transaction is completely appropriate for civil penalties, as is the case in most regulatory related matters like this in the statute. I think the addition of a criminal penalty, in my mind, complicates the bill. So I'm putting that on the record as one of my own concerns. You've pointed out some others. At the same time, I think everybody agrees that the provision of this bill that fixes the problem that existed under the 2001 bill that will spring back to life if we don't do something is there, and it needs to be dealt with. So I guess I'm looking to you three to sort of give us your indication that as we move this bill forward, you will address the concerns, if we move this bill forward, I guess, you'll address the concerns that we've got. And Representative Murphy, for me, that means the removal of the criminal penalty. I think that has to come out, in my own view. With that, with your commitment that you'll work to taking that out, I'll still move the bill today, but I need to know that before I feel comfortable letting it out of my committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make a comment about the criminal penalty, but I think I can meet the question that you've asked or the request that you've made. What we did is we have many of these incidents occur when a company declares bankruptcy, and therefore we had a fee structure, but the fee structure doesn't provide any penalty because bankruptcy shields. So what we did is we created three tests in order for a criminal penalty to apply. First, you had to completely ignore this bill and provide no warning to the buyer. Second, you had to fail to pay your subs such that there was an uncured right to lien. And third, upon this financial bomb going off underneath your purchaser, the person you're selling to, you had to refuse to remedy it. We put in what we call a good actor clause that says it is an affirmative defense if there is no liability incurred by the purchaser. And we asked the Legislative Council to go back and rework that language to make sure that if I, as a seller, find out that through error or mistake that my purchaser is now facing a penalty or a lien that they have to pay as a result of my failure to protect them or warn them, that I can completely cure my own risk by going and taking care of it. It was actually kind of designed as an incentive to get the problem cured for the consumer rather than something to negatively affect the seller. That by creating that structure, we were able to, in the situation when someone goes bankrupt, still create an incentive for the person to come back, and the person they failed to warn, they could cure it and save the customer from this disaster. So that was the reason for the structuring. I hadn't brought attention to the committee that it had that good actor piece in it, which is a rather unusual structure. And I don't know if that changes your viewpoint at all.
Well, let me tell you, Representative, I don't think it does, because it's still you still are in a situation where you can get somebody who's who didn't give the notice that they were legally obligated to give, and who has their financial situation, whether by bad management or whatever other reason, goes sideways, still be in a position where they potentially could be facing a criminal penalty and unable to remedy it. And if we do this, Mr. Markey will be up here at some point asking us to reinstate debtor prisons in this state. I mean, it takes us down a road where I think it disconnects it from. If this person did this with the necessary intent to defraud, then there are statutes already that address issues of criminal fraud within the current Oregon law, and I think that's the place where you go. But I don't know that you back into criminal penalties in this situation where someone didn't operate with the intent to, mm-hmm. to defraud, mm-hmm. And yet they could still be in a position where they're facing a criminal penalty. If they are, in fact, operating with the intent to defraud, there's both a civil remedy that the purchaser can use to sue them for civil fraud, and there are criminal penalties related to fraud. And if the amount is substantial enough, you could probably, in the right instance, and someday when we have money to fund a court system, get a district attorney to actually look at that possibility. But that's my concern, is that you have a situation where you can back somebody potentially into being subject to a criminal penalty when they didn't have, frankly, or might not have had a criminal intent. And if they did, I think there are other vehicles to get at them.
Mr. Chair, we'll use those other vehicles. And this was a conversation that Scott and I had earlier in the day, that was something we're going to have to explore, because I don't think on the Senate side that was going to survive Scott's support.
Any other comments? Representative Shetterly?
I do agree with you on the criminal aspect of this. I remember when this came through last session, I recall it didn't come through judiciary. We were both kind of surprised to see a Class A, it was then a Class A misdemeanor coming out of the Trade and Economic Development or whatever that was on a construction lien bill. And it,
they all had funny names last session. I don't remember what the committee was called.
Smart House Building.
Smart Growth and Commerce,
maybe.
I was on that committee. Well, but I don't remember this bill.
It might not have been that bill.
Yeah, okay. Anybody else? Representative Cremo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a concern about the $50,000 floor. The reason being that when somebody buys a home, it is generally many times their largest purchase. And whether they spend $49,999 for that home or $895,000 for that home, they still, if there's a problem with a lien, first of all, the person that is that's trying to perfect the lien should have that opportunity. But the other problem is that for a person who has made that purchase, they should be able to make sure that there's not going to be any liens placed on their property. So I guess my concern there is why we have the floor in there, and if that floor is going to protect the consumer adequately.
Representative Berkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Crummel. Referring you to Section 21A, lines 8 through 10, what this language does is it covers all new homes, new single-family residences, or residences that are not new but where there has been substantial renovation. And we had testimony in the work group that sometimes these liens occur where someone does a major renovation of their house, fails to pay the sub, sells it, moves to Florida, and the new owner gets hooked just as they get hooked by new construction. But all new construction, whether the new house costs $49,000 or $49 million, is covered.
Okay.
Right. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
A final comment on the title insurance. We will continue to pursue that. At the time the three of us were in the work group last year, it was the understanding of all three of us that this product was provided. We had a person present that, and I independently called title companies and asked several of them, and they indicated, and I think Scott had a similar conversation with the title company, and so concerns have arisen. We're going to track those down, and we're going to figure out the answer, because we were surprised.
Any other questions for the panel? You know, we're sort of, Here's the rub. We've got a bill that we got some concerns about, but we're interested on the timing issue and not, you know, putting this because of its necessary provision that I don't think anybody wants to see spring back to life in jeopardy based on timelines. And I'm frankly more concerned about Senate timelines. I think we could control the House timeline to address this issue, but I'm more concerned about getting it to the Senate on Senate timelines. I guess I'm interested, you know, I'm looking at the neutrals, and I know this is putting you in a bad spot, but are you comfortable with having adopted the Dash 1 amendments with us moving this bill out of committee, or do you want to continue to try to work the bill with Mr. Monroe on the title issues and get amendments on the criminal penalty issues and do that here in the House committee before we move it over? And I guess I know I'm putting you on the spot, but I think the committee is going to be somewhat decided based on the direction that you want us to go. Scott? That's why you get paid the big
Chair Williams, members of the committee, I think we are comfortable that and are concerned also about the timeline. So I think in the essence of time, we should probably try to move forward and continue to meet and solve the problems that we have in front of us.
Okay. Janet?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to second that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, then. Floyd, you made the motion, I think, already, or did you know?
No, we were in the process. Go ahead and made it.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3539 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 3539 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrill.
Just on the understanding that it is still under construction.
Yeah.
Put the construction sign on.
That was sort of a bad pun. Even the audience didn't laugh at that one. I think that's going to be important to sort of signify on the floor that because of the necessary natures, that this is something that is still a work in process. Okay.
So we've had the discussion. Now we'll have the vote.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3539 is amended and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
I'm going to assign that bill to Representative Przanski, who will make a very good record on the floor of the House as to the committee's position on the bill.
Under construction.
While we've got everybody here, before people slip out, I'm going to quickly ask for suspension of the rules to allow Representative Shetterly, Cremel, and Anderson to vote on House Bill 2646.
Hmm.
Is there any objection? Rules are suspended. Representative Shetterly, how do you vote on House Bill 2646?
Aye.
He votes aye. Representative Crummell?
I will vote aye.
Votes aye. Representative Anderson?
Let's make it a clean sweep.
All right. Aye. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Now we're going to go to House Bill 2094. Open a work session. Ask to come forward Mr. Shepard, the Deputy Attorney General. Colleagues, you will remember House Bill 2094 from it just seems like Wednesday that we talked. Oh, it was Wednesday that we talked about this bill. This is the one that relates to the tobacco product manufacturers' reports, and we had the discussion, as you recall, about the non-participating manufacturers and the manufacturers that are parties to the Master Settlement Agreement. And Mr. Shepard is here to enlighten us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As the Chair has noted, we're revisiting today the bill that we discussed on Wednesday. This is the bill involving the statute that's known as arrangement that's known as the Non-Participating Manufacturer Statute, or NPM law, which, as you recall, is designed to eliminate any economic disincentive for manufacturers to become participants in the Master Settlement Agreement. Diligent enforcement of that NPM, Non-Participating Manufacturer Statute, is essential to the state because it both helps us preserve the public health benefits of the Master Settlement Agreement and helps protect the fiscal benefits of that agreement. And the Dash 4 amendments that are before you will improve our ability to enforce that statute. By way of housekeeping, let me mention that I previously submitted to the committee on April 8th a document that's a bullet point, single-page description of the bill entitled Salient Points of House Bill 2094-1, and that applies with equal force to the Dash 4 amendments. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I've been authorized by all of the parties, including Mr. Koba's client, the Council of Independent Tobacco Manufacturers, and Mr. Gardner's client, Philip Morris, to join in recommending to the committee that the committee approve of the Dash 4 amendments and report the amended bill due pass to the floor. All of the participants in these discussions reserve the right to argue about the allocable share cap in the Senate. And in addition, if we find some defect in the matrix that is being distributed to you just now, some defect in the bill that will defeat the outcomes described in the matrix, then that too would be a point of further debate in the Senate. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the issue that was before the committee with a pointed focus on Wednesday was the question of how we deal with a warehouse in Oregon that holds product that may be destined for another state and either is permissible to be distributed in that other state or is not permissible. And the matrix that you have before you lays out the various permutations of how the Dash 4 amendments would apply, and the gist of that is that if the product is unlawful to be distributed in Oregon and the destination state, then the prohibitions under the bill would apply. Otherwise, it's our analysis that the state has very little interest in prohibiting the movement of that product, and so the Dash 4 amendments are intended to capture, and I believe do capture, the outcome described in the matrix before you. And as I've indicated, all of the parties support the Dash 4 amendments on the terms I've described.
Okay, has everybody looked at the matrix that sort of steps you through what, if compliant in Oregon, not compliant in Oregon, and the three boxes or the four boxes? And so basically the matrix, as I understand how it would work, and this is the amendment that's reflected in the Dash 4, that if they were compliant, if they were not compliant in Oregon and not compliant in the destination state, you could still nab the product as contraband.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay, but if they were non-compliant in Oregon but compliant in the destination state, you wouldn't grab the product as contraband unless you felt like, in fact, the product was actually truly destined, despite what they might say, truly destined for Oregon as contraband, non-compliant product, and that would be then a proof issue which the law enforcement authority which sees the product would have to prove in court.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay. All right, are there questions? Representative Brzezinski.
I move the Dash 4s into House Bill 2094.
Representative Brzezinski moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2094. Discussion? Any of the parties want to come up and put, you're all fine with Pete's resuscitation on the record? Okay, that's good. We appreciate you being judicious of the committee's time. All right, the motion is to move the Dash 4s. Any objections? The Dash 4s are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll now move House Bill 2094 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 2094 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? All right, let's go ahead and call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Kibonsky? Aye.
Representative
Federley? Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2094 is amended, also somewhat appears to be a work in progress, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman, are you feel comfortable carrying this bill?
I'm going to have to be re-educated, but I'll give it a try.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, going to open a work session on House Bill 3250.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may remove this bill from just fairly recently, too. This permits a court to require a security bond for a person who may travel outside the country. We had testimony concerning one lady who whose former husband kidnapped the kids and took them to Saudi Arabia. You have the Dash 3 amendments in front of you. Now, the amendments would just done today, and the interested parties took a look at them, and there still are some issues. For example, on page 1, line 10, it says, and the court finds by clear convincing evidence, etc., it may involve travel with a minor child to another country. I talked with Nancy Miller, who was here, as is Sybil Hebb, and the concern of the courts is that potentially means that in every custody issue, you would have a potential hearing on these issues, which has a potential for a fairly large fiscal. As you may remember, the testimony we had the last time, if you go over to page 2, as part of the bonding requirement the courts may consider, another country in which the parent has a strong connection, for example, is not in compliance with the Hague Convention on Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction, does not provide for extradition to the United States of a parental abducted child, has local laws, practices, etc., that goes to the bonding issue. Discussions I had out in the hallway, and this is a policy decision, I think that the people that have been involved in the bill need some time to think about this before they feel comfortable going this route or not. The testimony we had the last time, a woman from Saudi Arabia, they are not a member of the Hague Convention. They do not provide extradition to the United States. If the may travel were tied into that, it would substantially narrow the focus of the bill, and as a result, substantially narrow the fiscal impact. Now, that is a policy issue.
I also understand, I hear that the amendments, even outside of that, may need some additional work, and probably would be better off bringing the bill back next week after it had some time to work on it. See, the problem is if we pass the bill out the way it is now, it will have a substantial fiscal impact and probably go to Ways and Means Committee. Have to come back if we don't send it.
Right. Okay, why don't we go ahead and bring Nancy and Sybil up, and we'll just at least get some of the questions resolved that the committee might have. I think the committee's inclination was, as I recall from the last hearing, to make the amendments, and I think, Sybil, you folks had raised a number of issues that the bill in its original form, while you were supportive of what it was trying to accomplish, cut a broad enough swath that it concerned you on other issues, many of them sort of domestic violence protection-based issues, that it didn't go so broadly. And then, Nancy, you've obviously read or raised concerns about the impact of the court. I guess I'm still trying to track on Mr. Taylor's first question, which is, why would this be, would it just work better if it's just on motion? Why is it that in every custody instance there would need to be this finding as opposed to just on motion by the parent who was concerned about the possibility of this abduction?
Sure, members of the committee, it could be raised in every custody issue because may involve travel with a minor child to another country. There's no time limit, as you well know, and I guess Nancy Miller discussed this with the Judge Leggett and Judge
Darling
this morning, and as you may well know, in these kind of issues, lots of issues are raised, whether they're pertinent or not at the time. And
I guess I'm struggling to, and maybe it's my naivete, but the issue is a clear and convincing evidence of a risk of international abduction. Involving travel with a minor child to another country. I'm struggling to think that in every child custody case that a parent is going to, throw this out to sort of poke the other one in the eye when in the 20 years that they've been married, they've never traveled to another country. They don't have family in another country. They don't have any ties to another country. I think that it seems unlikely to me that it would be used that much. Nancy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Director of Court Programs and Services Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. Not every case by any stretch of the imagination. The issue that we talked about with the judges this morning, and Ms. Hebb and I have had this conversation, we have 18,000 custody filings per year. If 1% of the people decide to raise this and come back through the door on this, that's 180 hearings. If it's 10%, that's 1,800 hearings. Every time you deal with custody cases and FAPA cases, because the filings are so high, even a small percentage of people using this as a tool, and that's what the judges were concerned about. Judge Leggett has a lot of cases in her court where people are talking about going to Mexico. Judge Darling thought that this would be raised. I said, off the top of your heads, what's the lowest number that you think this could come up in? And Judge Darling said, 3 to 5%. So you'd think, that's probably reasonable. 97% of the people won't use this. 3% will. But when you do 3% of 18,000 cases, it sends your fiscal up. So we're trying to figure out how to apply this in the cases where it's really important and it is germane, and not open the door to hand another harassment tool to people who don't need it.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
You may remember.
Is Mexico, if a father takes off or a mother takes off with the kids, if I was married to a Mexican national, she runs home with the kids, can I get them back through the courts, or do I have to go down there and kidnap them back myself? I mean, is that a Hague, whatever we're looking at here?
Oh, we wouldn't recommend the latter, Representative Barker. We hear those Mexican jails aren't that great.
In my youth, when I could run down to the committee. Uh-huh. Right.
Representative Barker, Chairwoman, members of the committee. Mexico, I believe, is a signatory to the Hague Convention, but I think there's always a difference between what the theoretical relief is and the practical relief. And I don't know if the committee saw, apparently in the Oregonian this morning, there was an article on a child who was recently recovered, I believe just yesterday, from the jungle of Costa Rica. And Costa Rica is also a signatory, and that child had been missing since, I believe, 2001. So it's not easy by any stretch of the imagination just because there is this international convention.
Sybil, let me ask. I didn't read that story. Was it a law enforcement assistance with the government of Costa Rica following up on its obligations under the Hague Convention to recover the child, or was it a family sort of go down and grab the kid and get back into the jurisdiction of the U.S.?
Chair Williams and members of the committee, that's an excellent question, and I didn't read it either, actually. Sure. Laura Phillips, who was the woman who was testifying here, who had personal experience with children having been removed to Saudi Arabia, called me on my way down here to let me know that there was an arrest. I just got a message.
Representative.
Now, for the record, that was actually in the Register Guard a couple of days before, because it's a woman who lives in Eugene. It's her daughter, and FBI was involved. But there also were other people who she was not sure who to be thanking, who actually worked with law enforcement and locating the child on the beaches or in the jungle.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
A question for one or both of the witnesses. I guess my concern about this bill is that it seems like it's a fairly narrow set of circumstances that is likely to give rise to the problem we're trying to get at, and I think the concern that's being expressed is that we ought not put a mechanism in place that has broader kinds of consequences. And I'm wondering whether the issue we're getting at is when there is a parent who is has either foreign citizenship or dual citizenship, which would be the case where it would seem more likely that there could be an abduction to a foreign country, particularly one outside of the conventions that we work with. And I'm wondering whether that kind of a filter would make sense here. And there may be discrimination issues in singling out people who have a dual citizenship or sole citizenship elsewhere. But it does seem to me, if that were legally permissible, that might focus our energy is down, kind of screen out 99% of the cases, because I think the instance of U.S. citizen parents who have no dual citizenship, one of them taking off to a foreign country with the kids, is pretty unlikely.
Although, Representative McPherson, I will say that in the case that the woman presented to us, I believe, in the hearing last time, the father was, and I don't know that he was a he was an American citizen. The mother was an American citizen. I don't know that the father had dual citizenship in Saudi Arabia, but he had family in Saudi Arabia. And so his flight to Saudi Arabia, he was educated in the U.S. He'd grown up in the U.S. I think that there was it was a situation where, you know, he went to grandparents or whoever in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I do recall that he had at least U.S. citizenship, and whether he had dual citizenship or not, I don't know. And I suppose there's always the risk that, you know, I might go off to Scotland because I'm of Scottish descent and I still am in touch with a few relations over there. But that's less likely than maybe the case where somebody has at least dual citizen or at least dual citizenship.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering whether that kind of a filter might be the right kind of balance in this problem.
Ms. Hatt.
Thank you. Chair Williams and Representative McPherson and members of the committee. We had included in the list of factors that the court may consider in determining what type or amount of security or other measure to impart, the types of relationships that a parent may have with other family members or citizen or with the country, which I think would get at the issue of dual citizenship, although it doesn't specifically mention that. For example, if a court found there was clear and convincing evidence that there was a risk of international abduction, the court could then look at what kinds of ties and what kinds of harboring might take place in the other country in determining what type of relief to order.
But, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I guess the question is whether if we leave it open so that people can bring in those other sources of proof that there's a risk, then we create the fiscal impact of having that issue potentially raised in a broader number of cases. Mm-hmm. And if we decide that the cases that are going to be most probable of having the problem are cases of foreign citizenship, then perhaps by putting that kind of a filter on it, we take it down to the point where the fiscal impact is minimal or non-existent, and we get at the lion's share of the problem. That's the good choice I would pose.
And I appreciate that. I just have a couple of thoughts in follow-up to the chair and members of the committee. We had met fairly consistently since we were last here, a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, and had come to a consensus about amendments which we submitted, and they don't look exactly, of course, like what you see here in the printed amendments. So I think that's raised a few questions when we were just able to see those this morning. I think that the group probably would do well to consider some of this change in language in the judge's comments this morning. I think that some of the members of the group would be very concerned about narrowing the scope so much, and we did take great care to try to establish a fairly high level of proof. So it's clear and convincing evidence that there's a risk of international abduction, and then there's some factors. So it wasn't ever our intent to create something that would be easily lobbed back and forth, and I think there is a fairly high level of proof required. So I don't see that there would be that many cases where this kind of relief would be requested, although clearly we need to look at the judge's feedback on that issue.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't spoken on this bill or this issue, but I'm not exactly sure how in statute we deal with this problem. When we deal with, if you wish, a cross, pretty dramatically different cross-cultural sort of differences. The illustrations of Mexico and Costa Rica and some of those countries, I think that's probably something that is workable, but they are all signatories to begin with. The illustrations, I believe, that were before us in committee were from the Near East, where we have countries that are not signatories, mm-hmm. and where, in fact, we have very dramatically different value systems in those countries about mm-hmm. ownership. And ownership is, I think, the correct term mm-hmm. of the children. From my college and university experiences, a number of young ladies have married into these Near East families, and my personal experiences with it, limited though they may be, is more of them come to seriously regret it than come to live happy lives there, ever after, especially in relationship to issues like this with children. And since we first brought this up, this bill up, and since it first appeared, I've thought quite a bit about how we can grapple with that issue and how we can come up with a law that's going to be able to cope with that when we have countries that are not going to, clearly recognize those laws, and who have laws that are diametrically opposed to anything we do. And the issue of getting these kids out of the country, as far as, to the Near East, that's a relatively simple sort of thing to do. If it's going to be kidnapping, it really isn't going to make any difference what sort of issue the court has come up with, what kind of, securities that are set up, for it. Many of these people have, as we have discovered, I think recently, substantial means to do a variety of things, including getting their children out of the United States, or getting their families out of the United States. I could cite one example where one in personal experience sort of thing, where one member chartered a 727 jet to fly them out of the come into a small airport, pick them up, and fly them out of the country. So and I don't know how we deal with that. And it's a heart-wrenching story. And we have a lot of stories, you know, like this, I think. But I'm not sure where we go or how we do it, and I don't...
Yeah, Representative Jensen, you express obviously, I think, many of the concerns that all of us have, and certainly the idea of posting a bond will not solve every problem. There will be people who post the bond and still abduct the child and give up the bond amount. Now, the value of the bond to the family is that it will help in offsetting the cost that they use to attempt legally to try to recover their children. I mean, and that is the value of it. And that would be the value of it whether you're going to a Hague Convention signatory state or a non-Hague Convention signatory state. At least in a Hague Convention signatory state, theoretically, you can call and hire a lawyer in Mexico or Costa Rica or another Hague signatory country, and there is a legal process and a court process that you can use to try to get custody of your child again. And that bond is meant to offset that cost. So while it won't ever stop the abduction in every instance, it is some incentive for some people, and to the extent they still abscond, the bond would help cover the attempted costs associated with trying to recover the child. And I think that's got to be of at least some value to a family who, without it, will have to spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and probably several trips to the country and all sorts of other efforts that they'll have to make in trying to make that happen. Obviously, the challenge we're up against is that if we like the policy, we still have to figure out how it fits into the overall budget constraints that we're under. And that's where I think Representative McPherson's comments come in about, you know, trying to achieve some way to approach this problem to deal with the, you know, the most egregious of the cases or the most obvious areas. And I guess we're going to need to take a little bit of time to allow the work group to work through that. And I'm going to ask the courts to really think about how much additional, you know, how much additional time this is really going to take. And I'm going to want a pretty good write-up on the fiscal on this one. I think the committee is going to want to evaluate that. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell, Shetterly, Ackerman.
No, that was a stretch. That was
right. We'll knock it off. Representative Crummell.
I just would like to play devil's advocate for a moment. And I'm sure that this would not be...
Mr. Marquis already left the hearing.
...necessarily the most popular question to ask. But I think that it is important to ask because, and while we, in the testimony that we received, it's very gut-wrenching and very upsetting. We only are seeing one side of it. And so I guess the question that I would have is, how is this policy in the best interests of the child? And I think that as we look at custody issues, that should always be kind of the underlying question. To say that it is not necessarily in the best interest of the child for the father to run off to Saudi Arabia, is that as a blanket statement always true? And the reason why I say that is, what if the mother is an abusing parent? So it's just something that I guess a seed that I kind of plant, and if either one of you would like to try to
actually
answer it.
I want to take a crack at that if I can. Representative Crummell, I think the question is always a fair one. The answer to that question, however, is that it is never in the best interest of the child to ignore, I think, the legal process. And if custody is with one parent and the other parent is abusing the child, you know, there are all sorts of other legal remedies. You know, a phone call to services to children and families, your lawyer filing an expedited motion with the court on a custody issue. I mean, there are a plethora of legal remedies that one can immediately avail themselves of. Even temporarily taking the child and driving across town and staying at a friend's house versus running out of the jurisdiction with the child is a better remedy than essentially what under our law, if the child is legally in the custody of the other parent, would constitute kidnapping. It would be punishable by significant jail penalty if one were abducted. Representative Shetterly,
that was not a stretch. No, I think you're that's correct. And also, the fact that this bill is predicated on a custody order having been entered, and best interest of the child is always a consideration on which a custody order is made. So that determination, while it's not explicit in this bill, underlies the custody order that's a predicate for the effect of this bill.
Representative Ackerman, you had a comment.
Yes, on the Dash 3 amendments, there's sub A through 4, all in the disjunctive, which a finding on any one of those would invoke the provisions of the Act, yet I find that sub C, the parent has committed abuse as defined by statute against the other parent, or has committed child abuse, standing alone doesn't seem to me to justify the imposition of this order. Likewise, sub D, it might be a little bit more relevant, but stating that the parent has a relevant criminal record or a history of violating court orders also seems rather tenuous to me to support a court order of this magnitude.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I haven't even had a chance to sit down and talk to Ms. Hubb about everything. That was another issue that the judges raised, saying that we had already agreed on this language. One of the things the judges said was so many people could allege that. I mean, and exactly what you're saying, is there a nexus between being able to allege that and the potential of an abduction? So that's another thing that we want to talk about.
Okay. Anybody else? Oh, Representative Jensen, you'd signal.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to, and some risk involved here, harsh and unfeeling, but I have some concern that if we carry this this out and there is, you know, some kind of a bond that people might have. In a number of these cases, I think we run a risk of creating a false hope that you might be able to accomplish something. And I don't know which is the cruelest, which is the most difficult for the people to cope with. So, and it's not that I'm going to oppose the bill, but it's just one of the things that that I have to think about as I...
Sure. Well, we're certainly not ready to move it today. We'll ask the work group to continue to work on it, communicate with Mr. Taylor. I think he's got a reasonably good sense of the issues that the committee has concerns about. We'll see if within our time frame we can get something back that is a consensus bill. With that information, committee, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3250.
Thank you.
I'll just let the committee know that if you heard the announcement, we continue to struggle, but we are now Wednesday night, and instead of 5:30, we are Wednesday night at 6 because the floor session, the extra scheduled floor session, will run from 3:30 to 5:30. So we'll have a half an hour between the end of the floor session to grab a sandwich, and then we'll be back in here at 6 o'clock on Wednesday night and intend to go from 6 until we complete the agenda. All right. Thank you very much. All of you have a good weekend. The committee is adjourned.